How do you get your property education? Well, I started with podcasts, which are free. And if you combine them with Facebook groups, online communities, forums and books, that should provide you with much of the information that you'll get from a course for a fraction of the cost. Interviews are a great way for learning about a particular business model or a specific nuance of a strategy or about a person you're thinking of working with. And we've had more than our fair share of amazing interviewees. In fact, look no further than last week's guest, Grant Williams, who gave us a macroeconomic perspective from outside the UK property bubble. But some of the most useful content, according to people who get in touch with us, is when we tell parts of our story that don't go well. Because let's face it, we learn more from what goes wrong than what goes right. So over the next few episodes, we'll be covering the reasons why we didn't buy any property in 2023. You're listening to Expat Property Story, a podcast in which I share my story to smooth the way for you to have your own Expat Property
Story. Hello there. This is episode 150 of Expat Property Story, the most widely listened to UK property podcast in the world, with listeners in nearly 145 countries now. A quick bit of housekeeping, as they say, and if you're an Instagrammer and you'd like to follow the show, the handle is expat_property_story. And if you'd like to join the conversation on our WhatsApp group, then get in touch via the show notes. And finally, to get access to our monthly newsletter, our 23-step guide to buying property at auction, and our 37-question due diligence checklist, then subscribe to our growing email list, either via the links in the show notes or at expatpropertystory.com. We've been releasing this podcast every week without fail since February 2022. And along the way, we've told most of our story, but not quite all. And so I thought it might be useful to fill in the gaps, so to speak, and explain why it's taken so long between those mad couple of days in November 2022, when we bought our 2 3-bed semis that we now run as serviced accommodation, and the 4 properties we've agreed to buy in the last month. And for the full story of how we exchanged contracts on these 2 SA houses on successive days, just hours after being alerted to the deals, check out episodes 77 to 79. A couple of months prior to that, we'd completed our 4-month auction challenge to buy a UK property without leaving our home in Hong Kong, with just a couple of weeks to spare, by getting our hands on a block of 4 flats in a market town in Derbyshire. The flats were in such a state that there appeared to be a tree growing inside one of the ground floor flats. We'd bought the flats with cash recycled from our final student HMO, as well as savings from our rental income and expat salaries, as well as the final portion of our pension plan that we'd started back in 2009. This pension had been set up by our supposedly independent financial advisor. Long-time listeners to the podcast will know that this man has been much maligned from time to time on here, going all the way back to episode 1. In fairness, I have to say, he was actually a nice guy. If there's any blame to be attached to the whole pension plan, it's to us for being so financially naive when we'd started making plans for our long-term future after starting a family. In fact, we were so grateful for the upturn in our fortunes after we'd initially seen the funds in the plan our advisor had set up using the lump sum we'd accumulated in savings from our expat salaries, that we bought him a present to say thank you. My naivety reminds me of the first time I ever saw fruit machines. I must have been about 5 or 6, and we were on a cross-channel ferry. I saw people putting money into the machines, pulling the lever, and seeing pocketfuls of coins crashing out below. Free money, I thought. Fast forward 40 years, and I had the grown-up version. I don't remember exactly how much the initial lump sum was, but I think it may have been about £50,000. Well, pretty quickly, the value of the lump sum had risen significantly. But in the same way that the worst thing that can happen is to win your first bet at the bookmakers, we thought it would always work like that. So we invested more. What had actually happened was that we'd benefited from the post-financial crisis rebound. A large proportion of the funds had been invested in China and India, which both had incredible gains in 2009. China was probably the best performing market in the world by the end of that year, with gains of 80%. For people already invested in China, this represented a 15% gain, given that Chinese stocks had decreased by 65% the previous year. But for us, we'd had the benefit of the full 80% gain. The previous time I'd invested in stocks and shares had been when I'd invested £7,000 in a FTSE 100 ISA tracker in 1999 at the top of the market, and had to wait about 7 years for the fund to regain its initial value. This time, we'd bought at the bottom. Our advisor had also set up an accumulator fund, whereby we invested a proportion of our salaries each month. A year after the plans had been set up, both funds had risen so much in value that we thought, wow, easy money, and put another £10,000 in. This time, the profit line remained flat. Things remained flat for several years. In the meantime, the value of our London flat had doubled in 10 years. We went back to our financial advisor and told him we were thinking of investing in property. Too risky, he replied, as he thought about his disappearing commission instead of our future. A year or so later, as we saw that the sale value of the property we were renting in Hong Kong had doubled in just 5 years or so, we went back to him and repeated our desire to invest in property. He told us some story about how his brother had invested in property and it had all gone wrong. But this time, we decided to ignore him. In 2015, we cashed in some of the pension plan and bought a tiny one-bed apartment off-plan in Hong Kong for roughly £400,000. Within 2 years, it was worth nearly £600,000. Meanwhile, our London home had continued to increase in value, and that's how we caught the property bug. It was now 2017. We started to think about how we could get our hands on more property. So in 2018, we released about £200,000 of equity from our London flat and cashed in a little more of the pension and bought and refurbished our first student HMO in Nottingham. And after we refinanced it, we did the same again the following year. A year later, in 2019, we started to look at ways to move a little faster. I had already started to do a lot of research on matters relating to expat tax and the rules around tax residency and non-domicility and lots of other stuff drier than a cream cracker. And all of this research pointed me to one glaringly obvious insight. And it was that we would need to sell our Hong Kong property before returning to the UK to avoid being taxed by the British government for the gains. So we decided to sell. Now, as I record this, including the four properties we've just agreed to buy in Derby, we'll have bought 14 properties in total. And while they've all produced their fair share of stress, some more than others, none of that stress compares to selling a property in a falling market. Someone then approached us looking to invest £100,000. And after adding this to the cash recycled from our second HMO and the profits from our Hong Kong property, as well as a £30,000 loan at less than 2% interest from a Hong Kong bank, we went on an HMO buying spree and bought four HMOs in the middle of lockdown. As the UK went into full lockdown and the whole buying process ground to a halt, we subsequently had to pull out of one of the purchases. And for another, we missed the deadline to get it refurbished and on market in time for the new academic year in the autumn of 2020. So, by the time we were able to recycle our cash from our 2020 spending spree, it was late 2021. COVID had spooked us a little in terms of having all our eggs in the student HMO basket. So, we decided to look for three-bed semis to run as serviced accommodation, but which could be repurposed as single lets if necessary. We thought we'd found someone who could source, project manage and operate serviced accommodation properties in Bolton. But at the last minute, they started talking about increasing their commission in 6 months' time, which was a red flag for us. So we lost confidence in them and moved on. By this time, the UK had become a seller's market for property, and we were struggling to add to our portfolio of five student HMOs and our original London flat. It was at this stage that we started the podcast to both grow our network and seek out the best available advice from UK property experts. The market was hot and we still hadn't added to our portfolio. But when John Howard of Property Graduate and Property Elevator fame appeared on episode 19 and suggested we look at the auctions, we had the idea to start a new season of the podcast in which we set ourselves our four-month auction challenge. During this time, we looked at all sorts of properties, from standard terraced houses to vacant pubs to mixed-use buildings to holiday cottages, short lease flats, ambulance depots, guest houses, industrial units, care homes, and everything else in between. And finally, with just a couple of weeks to spare, we bought an ex-police station that had long since been converted into a block of 4 one-bed flats in Heena, a market town in Derbyshire. If you'd like to know more about this deal, I talked a little bit about it in episode 140, Who Can You Trust in UK Property? And also in episodes 46 to 49, when we bought the block. But as a brief summary, the flats had gone unsold in a previous auction when they had not been marketed as vacant because there was at least one flat still tenanted. But this time around, although the marketing said that the flats were being sold with tenants in situ, the special conditions document, which, unlike the promotional material, is a legally binding document, stipulated that the block was to be sold with vacant possession. So, we made a pre-auction offer at 10% above the guide price, and after being mucked around by the vendor and the auctioneer for 2 weeks, our offer was finally accepted. We hastily arranged a video walkthrough with Vuba, at which point it became apparent that there was still a tenant in one of the upstairs flats. But the tenant was friendly and let the Vuba agent in to look at the flat and told us that it was being rented to her boyfriend and that they were all moving out the following week. So we put down a 10% deposit and exchanged contracts under typical auction conditions, which meant that completion had to take place within 28 days or we would lose our deposit. We'll be back with the podcast in a second, but I just wanted to let you know that we help high net worth individuals who perhaps don't have the time, expertise, or contacts to find deals that stack right now. We can offer fixed rate returns of up to 12%. So instead of watching your savings get swallowed by inflation, why not schedule a free call via the link in the show notes to see how we might work together? Now, back to the pod. Someone in our network reached out and said, quote unquote, "If you need any support with this, John, just let me know." Now, this person worked with registered providers of social housing, and one such provider was apparently desperate for one-bed flats in this location. So that was one option for the flats. I also looked into running them as serviced accommodation. AirDNA is a short-term rental data analytics platform, and they have a calculator for estimating how much any property in the world could generate as a short-term let. So I ran the address through AirDNA and found that the average daily rate was £127 and the occupancy was 85%. But on further investigation, I discovered that the average daily rate for a one bed was higher than for a two bed and also had a higher occupancy. This gave me doubts about DNA's accuracy in this particular case. So I contacted a local serviced accommodation managing agent who cast doubt on the figures presented on AirDNA. So in the end, we abandoned the idea. But later conversations with SA experts Mark Simpson in episode 80 and Louise Tomlinson in episode 83 both left me feeling that we should perhaps have placed more faith in AirDNA's estimates. I sometimes wonder whether we should perhaps have tried two of the four flats as short-term lets. Heena is, after all, on the edge of the beautiful Peak District. In the end, we decided that we would go down the social housing route, which meant that post-refurb, the flats would need a minimum EPC rating of C. We signed a management contract with my contact and asked them to pick up the keys and check that the flats were indeed vacant immediately before completion. They replied saying no worries, but there were plenty of worries, because when they did eventually go round to inspect the property ahead of the refurb, it turned out that the tenant was still there. The auction house tried to fob us off with the catalogue listing saying that the property was tenanted, but we replied with a copy of the special conditions. We reached a stalemate, so I passed everything on to my solicitor, who did solicitor-type threatening actions, and fortunately, a month later, the remaining tenant moved out. My new property partner for this project then gave me a price for the refurb that I had checked out by a third party, who told me that he could do it for 10 grand cheaper and could start the following week as opposed to 6 weeks later, which was when the other guy had told me he would start. After the key debacle, I decided to cut ties as far as possible, although the management contract had already been signed, so I had no option but to have them manage it for the time being. The refurb started in November and finished in mid-January. We'd bought the flats with cash for £230,000, and the refurb costs, including project management, came to just under £100,000. Next, we turned our attention to how much we should submit as our projected valuation. HomeTrack estimated each flat to be worth $87K, whereas Net House Price offered a range of between $104K and $127K per flat. My own research revealed some new builds at between $115K and $130K, although these were within a gated community. After consulting our mortgage broker, we decided to ask for a valuation of $110,000 per flat, so $440K in total. There was no way that the rental income would support a 75% loan-to-value on that after stress testing, but it felt good to know that we had at least made a tidy paper profit. Although, as my good friend Dave says, you can't eat equity. However, the interest rates for social housing were prohibitively high at the time, so in the end, we decided to put the flats on the market on standard ASTs, and two of the flats rented out almost immediately. I opted for a five-year fix at 6.49% with a 3% fee, as opposed to 6.19% with a 4% fee, although the difference is marginal. Now, I've been critical of lenders lowering their interest rates while increasing their arrangement fees, but I've recently heard an alternative perspective, which is that the fees are not included when it comes to stress tests. So, when you have two options, which on first inspection leave you thinking that if lenders don't make their money on the rate, then they make it on the fee, they might argue that they're offering you, as the borrower, flexibility. So anyway, after choosing our rate and instructing the valuation, we were looking forward to releasing a nice fat chunk of cash to continue building our portfolio ahead of our move back to the UK in a few years' time. Everything was looking good for 2023. I've always liked the number 23, and I'm not alone. Lots of people associate significance to this number. In ancient Chinese culture, for example, 23 is significant because it's the only prime number made up of an even number 2 and an odd number 3. In fact, there's a whole movement of people obsessed with the number who call themselves 23rdians, and they attach a more mystical association to 23 as it's a number considered sacred to Eris, the Greek goddess of chaos, strife, and discord. Well, in our case, it didn't take long for 2023 to descend into, if not chaos, then definitely strife and discord. The first bad news was around the valuation. Now, lots of people bandy about the term down valuation, and frequently it's not so much a down valuation as a lack of understanding by the borrower around the whole valuation process. And I guess our valuation is a case in point. The report came back on March the 1st. You'll remember that we asked for $440,000, but the report said just $295,000. I had to read it three times to make sure I'd understood it correctly. I was gutted. In the past, we've at least got the cost we paid plus the cost of the refurb, but this time, we'd paid $230,000, spent almost $100,000 on the refurb, including project management, so we'd been expecting $330,000 as our worst-case scenario. Not a paltry $295,000. The report stated that there was no market for selling the flats individually, so we couldn't have a bricks and mortar valuation. Instead, they valued the property on a commercial basis, and their estimates of the rent that could be achieved were below £600 per flat, whereas they were being advertised as £650 per flat, and in the end, all the flats were rented out at £625. They applied a multiplier or yield of 10% on their estimates and somehow came up with a final figure of $295,000. I asked our broker if we could appeal, and he basically advised us against it. This is what he told me.
To challenge their report, we would need to produce proof that the properties can be sold individually. We would need to find a multi-unit of a similar size and condition in the same postcode where units have been sold off individually within the last 3 months. You also need to find multi-units with a yield less than 10% that have sold in the same postcode within the last 3 months to have a chance of increasing the valuation. The valuer in his report states that these comparables aren't available. So, the further we go out by distance and time, the more difficult it is to challenge the report. And if we go to another lender, the same valuer may be used.
Somewhat confusingly, the lower the yield percentage, the higher the valuation. So to guarantee a higher valuation, we also need to find a lower yield. My broker was doubtful about this.
We also need to find a lender who would use a lower yield based on current market conditions. And with other valuation reports I've seen, 10% looks accurate.
He also told us that when carrying out any refurbishment, a comprehensive valuation needs to be done at the beginning with end values based on both bricks and mortar and yield, and along with a list of comparables from a specialist valuer. Now, it would have been nice to have been told all of this beforehand, but as I reflect on this a year or so later, it's a valuable learning experience and very relevant to our new business model moving forwards. So we had two options: accept the valuation and move on, or go to another lender. Now, bearing in mind that in early 2023, the Bank of England base rate had been increased in the previous 10 consecutive meetings of the Monetary Policy Committee, there was every chance that by the time we'd instructed a second valuation, interest rates would be even higher. And the valuation would probably come in at a similar figure. So we decided to bite the bullet, swallow our medicine, and learn from our mistakes, the biggest of which was not to have commissioned a valuation ahead of the refurb. As it turned out, the rate did indeed rise in the following four sessions before it settled at its current rate of 5.25%. So we made the right decision. And it's worth pointing out that as long as you're not relying on the release of funds to pay back investors, so-called down valuations are not as bad as some people would have you believe. Firstly, if you believe that the property is worth more than the valuer has estimated, then it's worth remembering that the value is still in the property, and you could always refinance further down the line, by which time you could get a more sympathetic valuation. And the other thing to factor in is that the lower the valuation, the lower your mortgage costs and the higher your cash flow. The main reason we were peeved was because it meant that we would have less money to scale our portfolio. But after 24 hours coming to terms with things, we came to the conclusion that it wasn't the end of the world. So we accepted the valuation and instructed our mortgage broker to go ahead with the mortgage. Just 5 days later, we had our next piece of bad news. But that will have to wait until next week. Here are three things to take away from today's episode. 1. Don't depend too heavily on others. This is a tough one because as expats or remote investors, even if you wanted to, you can't check up on everything. But when we relied on our new managing agent to check the flats were vacant just before completion, in retrospect, we should have made an extra phone call to really make sure it had been done. And in fact, a couple of months later, when we bought another property at auction that was sold with vacant possession, this is exactly what we did. 2. If you're doing something new, like, for example, buying a multi-unit block when previously you've only bought houses to convert to HMOs, it's kind of like learning a new language or a new game with its own specific rules. We had no idea that the flats would be valued on a commercial basis as opposed to bricks and mortar, so in retrospect, we should have had that conversation with our mortgage broker prior to purchase. And actually, this is an argument for sticking to one strategy or business model, because once you've done a couple of similar projects, there will be fewer surprises to catch you out. Which brings us neatly along to the final takeaway from today. 3. Things are not always going to go as well as you plan. Entrepreneurs are by nature optimistic, because if you don't think something will work, then you wouldn't be trying it in the first place. But you have to couple that with the realization that frequently things are going to go wrong, and almost train yourself to expect that, and to have the right mindset to deal with bad news as and when it comes. If you can adopt an attitude where bad news brings out the best in you, then you won't go too far wrong. That's it for this week. Next week, in true 2030ian style, there'll be more chaos as we continue our 2023 expat property story, which yielded no more properties to add to our portfolio. But before you feel too sorry for us, 2024 is going really well so far, as we've done more deals already this year than in the previous 3 years combined. And we've got more deals in the pipeline. So watch this space and share the show to spread the word. You've been listening to Expat Property Stories.